This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles, and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired, entertained, and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion of Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Phil Horegi of Sabre Systems and David Cooper of the Bank of America. We have an incredible lineup of guests for you today, including John Rendon, co-founder and president of the Rendon Group, Gretchen McCracken, co-founder and CEO of Golden Key Group, Dave Hunt, CEO, and Amy Hunt, president of Land and IP, and Travis Reese, President and COO of Mandiant. Let's get started. I'd like to introduce to you our first guest, John Rendon. John is the co-founder and president of the Rendon Group. Welcome, John. And what is the Rendon Group?
We're a global strategic communication consultancy. We've worked in 97 countries, usually for heads of government or cabinet ministers.
Well, what does strategic communications mean?
We help people tell their story in a timely, truthful, and transparent fashion.
And most of your work is done overseas, from what I understand. Can you give us an example of some work that you've done that was particularly interesting?
Well, going back to the late 1990s, we did the strategic communications support package for the White House in Y2K, which is the only scheduled crisis in the history of mankind.
You also said something about the liberation of Kuwait. Tell us about that.
Right, and then in the first Gulf War, we provided support to the government of Kuwait. And so the visual images you saw from downtown Kuwait City were ones that we helped the Kuwaitis tell as they told their story.
So I'm interested to know, the support that you provided is helping them to do what?
Well, it's to talk through the stories they want to tell and the times in which they want to tell them. So it's creation, it's help with production, and it's help with dissemination.
So the visual images that we saw on TV of the liberation of Kuwait, you had a direct hand in determining and helping frame what parts of the story that
well,
we saw.
Well, an indirect hand in as much as journalists will tell the story they want to tell when they want to tell it about what they want to tell. To the extent that we could work with the Kuwaitis in advance to have them think about how their stories could be told, in essence, policy to pictures, that's the support we provided. But the Kuwaitis deserve the bulk of the credit.
How long have you been doing this, John?
1,000 years.
And the company has been around for how long?
2,000. Actually, from the second start of the right and straight on to morning.
Okay, and otherwise known as 1981, right. January of 1981.
That's correct.
And we're going to get to the founding in just a moment. How big or small by whatever metric?
Roughly, we're just over 100, oscillate up to 150 from time to time.
Okay. And something happened in 1980 that compelled you to start a company.
So in the late 20s, I was executive director and political director of the Democratic Party, director of scheduling in advance for President Carter, during his reelection campaign. And in 1980, Ronald Reagan won the presidential election. We were out of work. My brother Rick and I, being good Democrats and believed in creating jobs, we started by creating a company with our own jobs and then added people to it.
You know, I'm curious. You found new work, obviously, because you had to. But to what degree was there a sense of we need to keep moving the cause forward even though we lost the election? Was there any of that involved?
Well, yeah, there's a very interesting dynamic because it's a generational issue, and I've seen the differences over time. So we came out of the McGovern campaign. A large number of the state coordinators for President Carter's, Governor Carter's race for the presidency came out of McGovern, and that was that period of time where you believed that if you participated in the system and you saw something was wrong, you could right the wrongs through participation.
Yeah.
And we grew up believing that there was nothing that couldn't be accomplished.
Wow.
And so having lost the election, we continued with that spirit and just took it into the private sector.
Wow.
And the last time I have seen that spirit evident in the United States was President Obama's campaign.
Yeah. Hey, tell us a little bit about how communications changed. Obviously you have social media now, and we've seen the incredible effect that that's had. Recently. How has that changed the way you do business?
Well, if you think about communications as a sector of the economy, and communications and communicating information, not cell phones or television sets or tablets, mobile phones, communications is the only field of endeavor where every innovation is additive.
What does that mean?
That means it does not replace a prior one. So if you think back to writing on walls, then verbal communication skills, the advent of the printing press, radio, telex, telegraph, into faxes, which were regressive technologies, then into the internet. All of those were additive. They were added on top of each other. Social media comes along after that. If we're really going to look at this, we would say it took radio 50 years to reach 50 million people. It took television 13 years to reach 50 million people. It took the internet 6 years to reach 100 million people.
Wow.
And what has happened now is that we're in a hyper-dynamic communications environment where it runs all the time, everywhere. And that's a big difference, because in the past, to your question, we would get a newspaper twice a day. Some people would even remember milk being delivered. You would decide that television news would be on at 6 p.m., and you would have this thing called supper or dinner, right, depending upon what part of the country you were in. And that was all by your choice. And now newspapers are all but gone. This is all about individual empowerment. And social media has served as an accelerant or an enabler.
John, this interest in communications and world issues goes way back, you told us, in the green room. Specifically, some things you did in high school with Model UN?
Yeah, I was very fortunate. Our parents, my brother and I were the only children. They were first-generation, we were first-generation Americans. They came over post-World War II from Europe. So they were always requiring that we had discussions about what was going on in the world at the dinner table. Then when I was in high school, I was part of a Model United Nations team, freshman year, sophomore, junior, senior, and really got into it. I used a language which, my father spoke six languages, my mother spoke four, and French was the language I learned. And so, representing Senegal, France, one is best speaker, three of the 4 years, best delegation, four of the four. So that set me on that path.
Great. You have an international memory at 6 years of age. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. First trip overseas, 6 years old, my parents took me to Paris. I remember the balcony. I remember the balcony looking out from the balcony to the Eiffel Tower. And also I remember breakfast.
When most children today are playing video games or watching TV, you were having conversations about world events with your parents. How did that happen?
How did which happen? The conversations with my parents?
Yeah, I mean, how did they foster a family in which you bought into that and it worked?
Well, it was normal. I mean, but eventually we started off by talking what was on the front page of the newspapers and what it meant. What it meant to my parents, how they viewed it. But then they would ask questions, of us as we were very young. What did it mean to us? And so that sent us scurrying, trying to figure out what the question was, let alone try to figure out the answer. Now we would have Wikipedia to provide a support package. But I will say this, that eventually we had television creep into the dining room table, and it became an extra member of the household, sort of an unauthorized IRS dependent.
So you'd have something to comment on. I guess you'd be watching the evening news and you'd be able to have a conversation and discussion about it. Where did this, passion, I'll say, for public service come about? Because, throughout your career, that's something that seems to be very notable.
So it's the intersection of my parents. My father was probably the hardest working person I've ever known. He passed when he was 90. And he was still going to work, taking the train from suburban New Jersey to New York City as a stockbroker. And he would always do that, very hardworking. So I think I learned determination from him. My mother, very outspoken, was a believer that if you weren't part of the solution, you were part of the problem. And if we saw a wrong, we should endeavor to right it. And the intersection of that, both for my brother and for me, led us to look at work as a calling, not as a job or a career.
Looking back on your career and everything that you've seen in world events, government, politics, what advice would you give someone?
Well, the first thing that I would do looking towards the horizon is fearful of some of the dynamics of the United States to become too insular, looking inward. I think the real opportunities for the United States rest outside our borders, and I think the strength of the United States of America comes from the diversity of its population. So, to that extent, if I had the magic wand and would wave it, I would make the third year of high school in the United States mandatory overseas and not care what direction they go in.
And you're basing that opinion on what in your experience? What have you seen or what have you experienced that makes you believe that?
Because every place that I've traveled, and I've been fortunate, I mean, the world has created an opportunity for me to learn every single day. 2 years ago, I circumnavigated, went around the world 14 times. That's a lot.
Wow.
I've been to a lot of countries, but I have learned that every country and every culture has something that we can learn from.
John, give us the web address for the Rendon Group, please.
Rendon, rendon.com.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with John Rendon, co-founder and president of the Rendon Group. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Phil Horegi of Saber Systems and David Cooper of the Bank of America, for helping me structure the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, www.executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back in a moment after this important business spotlight.
Hi, this is Paul Smith from the Potomac Companies with your business spotlight, and joining us today is...
Jessica Druckmann.
Jessica, and what company are you with?
I'm with Concero.
And Jessica, what is Concero?
Concero is a company that puts together events for senior-level executives. They're intimate, invitation-only, and take place over the course of 2.5 days.
So are these like CEO getaways to Las Vegas kind of things?
Not exactly. We actually say to leave your golf clubs at home. They are serious events. We bring executives together to network with each other, forge new relationships, benchmark, learn new ideas to bring back to their organizations.
Are there specific type of target companies you work with?
We aim for Fortune 1000 companies, the larger organizations for the most part. Most of our events are function-driven, so we put events together for general counsel, CFOs, CIOs, for example.
What do you enjoy most about your job?
What I enjoy most about my job is I have the opportunity to speak with and meet some of the most accomplished people. On top of that, when I'm at the events and meeting people and speaking with them and being in a room with executives all at the same level, sharing ideas and learning from each other, it's an amazing experience. And hearing from them that we've brought value to them, both to their organization and to enhance their career, is truly rewarding.
And Jessica, how can someone reach you?
They can reach me at jdruckmann@concero.com. Our website is www.concero.com.
This is Paul with your Business Spotlight. We've been speaking with Jessica from Concero. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion of Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation. And I'd like to introduce to you our next guest, Gretchen McCracken, co-founder and CEO of Golden Key Group. Welcome, Gretchen. And what is Golden Key Group?
Thank you, Mike. Golden Key Group is a women-owned, service-disabled veteran small business that focuses on federal human resources and human capital management.
Okay, let's define some terms. What
sure.
is federal human resources?
Federal human resources is the process by which the federal government uses to hire new federal employees or move them from one agency to the other. And we work in the operational and transactional world helping support the federal government to do that.
And how about human capital management?
Human capital management is a little bit broader. It is more of what people would understand as talent acquisition or talent management, which involves workforce planning, succession planning, competency mapping and modeling, performance management, onboarding, recruiting techniques, retention techniques. It's the full life cycle of dealing with your human resources.
Why is this particularly challenging working with the federal government in this area?
Well, for two reasons right now. The first one of those is the fact that it is very complex to hire somebody into the federal human resources or the federal arena.
Why is that?
Because there are a bunch of the federal human resources process is governed by a lot of law and codification from the Code of Federal Regulations, the FAR, et cetera, in order to get people hired into the federal government. And it's designed to make the process fair and equal. And so there are a lot of laws that go with it, and so there's a lot of time that it takes to get somebody hired into the federal government.
So the end benefit to me, Joe Taxpayer, of what you do is what?
What we do now as the expansion of that in that human capital arena is align now the performance that the people are, that the workforce is doing for the federal government so that you have the alignment between the agency and what their strategic plan is and what that individual is doing, and are you optimizing what that person is doing to get the best value for the taxpayer dollar.
How big or small is Golden Key Group?
Golden Key Group was started in 2002. We're approximately 75 people right now, and we're about $14 million in revenue.
So, Gretchen, how do you come up with the idea to start this? I mean, where did this just pop out of the air?
The idea to start the organization actually happened back in 2002. My sister, who was one of my business partners, came to me and asked me to come up with something that we could do as partners in terms of a business. She was retired from the military, and I was retired from the emergency services.
Now, your sister is sort of like a shrinking violet, isn't she? So how did she come up with this ultimatum to help me start a business?
Well, my sister is retired Navy. She was EOD, so essentially she blew up bombs underwater. Okay. And so after 23 years of doing that and then doing it in the private sector where they were doing base cleanup of old munitions and other objects so that they could change whatever they were going to be using the bases for, she came to me one day and said, "You were the smart one in the family. You had the brains, and I'm getting too darn old to run from these, so come up with something for us to do." So government contracting ended up in our path.
And we're going to get to how why it became government contracting in a few minutes. But what kind of relationship did you have with your sister growing up?
Well, I was the youngest of four. There were two boys, two girls, and they all came out of my siblings were all military, one Army, one Navy, one Coast Guard, and I was emergency services. And my sister had a very short string when we were growing up, and so a lot of things that we did were settled generally out of fist fights. So when she came to me and said, "Come work with me," I was a little taken back by that because we didn't ever actually get along on anything that I could remember other than the fact that we were related to each other.
How did you, or what prompted you to start your career in emergency services?
I started my career in emergency services when I was 16. That's back when you were allowed to do that. And I think that came from the fact that when I was very young, I was only about 3 years old when my father had his first heart attack. He was relatively young, but that being said, he was a veteran of World War II. He had landed at Utah Beach and fought his way through the Battle of the Bulge and into Berlin. And he had a massive heart attack at a very young age, and that had a very profound impact on me. And so I went into the EMS side and became an EMT when I was 16, and then got into the fire service and then got into the rescue service. And by the time I was 18, I was an instructor at the county level. This was up in Pennsylvania. And then I went to the state level, became the first female state instructor for Pennsylvania, and then went on to the national
level. So what prompted all of this? I mean, you decided this was going to be your career as a result of something that happened with your father when you were 3 years old?
It was that desire to help, to make a difference, and to be there in that emergency type of scenario. And you do a lot of that type of work without, I use this loosely, without thinking. I mean, it's a reaction. You do the reaction, and then you adjust and improvise as you go along.
In truth, your father had a series of heart attacks.
Yes.
And so tell us about your involvement with those heart attacks.
He had his first one, like I said, when he was 43, and then he had his next one when he was about 60. And I worked on him for approximately 47 minutes in order to bring him back. And
what did that feel like?
At the time, I think the worst part about it was I felt bad when I broke his ribs. I did that, and I really didn't think about it other than it was a life that had to be saved.
So
in this particular case, it was my father, and I was not willing to give up, and failing was not going to be an option.
Were you sort of in the zone, in other words?
I was in the zone.
Okay. And that happened a couple of times, didn't it?
It did. It happened when he was 60 years old, and then it happened again when he was 61, and it happened again when he was 62, and all three of those times I actually worked on him and brought him back, and the fourth time when he was 63, I walked in, and he was already on the floor, and I was too late, and we ended up having, that was the last time.
Yeah, so. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. What did it feel like knowing that you had brought your father back to life?
That was a particularly gratifying feeling to know that I made a difference, that I was there, and that he got a few more years of quality time with my mom, with our family. I was young. I had young children, so these were his only grandchildren that he got to see, and they were his world. And he was very, very close to my oldest one.
Do you have any idea how your father felt knowing that his daughter had brought him back to life?
He and I was the youngest of the four, so I was daddy's little girl. And he was always, he knew I would be the one that would be there till the very end. And it's just the way it was.
What was it like growing up with your dad and mom? You grew up where? What kind of environment was that?
I grew up in a very unique situation. I like to call it the absolute leave it to beaver type of an environment. I grew up in a house that my parents moved into in 1963. My mother, God bless her, still lives in that same house. Mm. It was the typical four-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bath, two-story colonial on a square quarter-acre lot. Tons of kids in the neighborhood, the elementary school right there. I was one of those unusual kids that went to one elementary school, one junior high, one high school, started it with one set of parents, ended it with the same set of parents and the same siblings. And when I started kindergarten, there were 23 kids in my kindergarten class. 17 of them were from my block going to school, and of the 17, 12 of us graduated from high school together.
Did that sort of upbringing shape you in any way?
Absolutely.
How so?
You understood the value of family. You understood the value of neighborhood. I'm going back to a time period where if your next-door neighbor was babysitting you or one of the next-door neighbor mothers was watching you, you respected them as you would your own parents. And if you didn't, you didn't want to be in the firing line when your parents got home.
Yeah.
And so it was truly an environment where everybody knew what everybody's kids were doing, and the kids came out really good.
Yeah. You came out so well that you saved your father's life multiple times.
Yeah.
What was it like making the decision to pull the plug the last time?
It was very hard, but I knew it had to be done. We got him into the hospital. I watched all night long. Ironically, it was a scenario where my parents had just come back from the airport from dropping my sister off, who was going out to spend Thanksgiving with my younger brother, and with our brother. And my father, it was our father's favorite holiday, was Thanksgiving, and he did not want our brother being alone. He was in the Coast Guard, had just transferred out to California. So my sister got on the plane, flew out there. And when he had the incident, I was at the hospital because, of course, I went in with the ambulance. And my mother and I were there, and I had to call them. Literally, they had just walked in from the airport when I told them, don't even unpack, don't get the suitcase out, come back. And by the time they got back the following day, which was Thanksgiving morning, it was too late. It was already done, and I made that conscious decision to make sure that they didn't see what I saw that night, because that was not our father.
Gretchen, you've built an incredible business, and you've had a tremendous amount of success. If your father was alive today, would he be surprised at the success that you've had? What would he say?
I don't think he would be surprised by it. He instilled a very high work ethic amongst all of us from our very first paper routes when I was 8 years old till going through school. And as a school teacher, he was a sixth grade school teacher, and he had a simple motto, and his motto that he just drilled into us was, a failure is never a failure unless you fail to learn the lesson. And so everything that we did throughout our life was a lesson. And there was always room for improvement. There was always room for a good job, but there was always that chance to say, what could I do better? What will I do next time? So you're constantly in that evaluation mode. And that's a good skill to have.
Yeah. Gretchen, give us the web address for Golden Key Group, please.
The web address is www.goldenkeygroup.com.
Thank you, Gretchen. We've been speaking with Gretchen McCracken, co-founder and CEO of Golden Key Group. I'd like to thank my co-host, Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation, for helping with me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, www.executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back in a moment after this important business spotlight. I'm Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Tim Keim.
And Tim, you're with whom?
Leadership Greater Washington.
And what is that?
We connect business leaders from business, government, nonprofit, get them collectively working together on issues facing Greater Washington.
Okay. There's a lot of organizations that sound like they do that. How is yours different?
Well, we focus on regional issues, focusing on making sure folks that work together should work together. We really believe in the power of relationships, so I'm kind of a matchmaker of folks who have influence, and we really kind of inspire their collaborative efforts.
So people or companies who would need that sort of help, give us some examples.
Well, anyone from a nonprofit CEO who's kind of siloed needs to connect with other folks, a business leader who has the ability to make change, or a government official needs to know more about what's going on, not just in his or her jurisdiction, but across Greater Washington.
Okay. Can you give us a success story?
Yeah, let me use the Fishing School. It's a nonprofit that helps folks in Northeast Washington focus on boys and girls getting after-school services. They were about ready to go under, but because their leader was in Leadership Greater Washington, got connected with business folks who transformed the organization. Came in, did a business plan, did a marketing plan, communications plan, and now the organization has touched thousands more lives as a result.
Tim, what is your web address?
www.lgwdc.org.
We've been speaking with Tim Keim of Leadership Greater Washington. My name is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Brian Biondi, of League Asset Corporation. And I'd like to introduce to you our next guests, Dave Hunt, who is the CEO, and his wife, Amy Hunt, who is the president of a company called Landon IP. Welcome, Dave and Amy, and what is Landon IP?
Landon IP is a professional patent search company that's located in Alexandria, Virginia. We conduct patent searches for patent attorneys that are at legal departments and companies and at law firms.
Okay. Can you give us an example of a patent search and why it's important?
Well, we try to provide patent searches that will allow our clients to decide whether they can get a patent, and also patent searches that try to kill a patent that should not have been granted.
Well, what happens when someone doesn't do the proper patent research?
If they don't do it, they're at risk of putting their life's work forward and then losing that to the public.
For example,
Dippin' Dots. That's a company that has a wonderful invention, but the gentleman who started the company actually showed Dippin' Dots at a county fair a year before he filed a patent application, and then he lost his patent rights because you can't do that.
Wow. How big or small is Landon IP?
Landon IP is about $25 million a year in revenue, and we have 150 employees.
And you founded the company when?
Well, I actually bought the company in 1998, in June of 1998. I should say Amy and I bought the company.
And it's because of what reason?
it looked like a great opportunity to work for myself, and frankly, I got sick of working for anybody I've ever worked for.
Yeah, actually, that's exactly what you said in the green room, is I was sick of working for others. Where did that drive to work for yourself and not others come from?
It really came from my mom. I was raised by a single mom, and she had was divorced when I was 4 years old and had three boys under the age of five.
Wow.
So for us, we really learned from her how to work for ourselves and how important it was.
In fact, you were on welfare.
We were on welfare, yes.
Tell us what that was like.
It was terrible. I mean, we had food stamps. Our money was a different color than anybody else, and we struggled to get by. We didn't know where food would be put on the table one day to the next, and my mom worked very hard. In fact, she took a job at Fuller Brush, selling brushes and brooms door-to-door, just to make ends meet. And she couldn't afford childcare, so she would bring me and my two brothers with her door-to-door, and we would hold the brushes and the brooms as she sold them. That allowed her to sort of cover for childcare and at the same time watch us and make money and set her own hours so she didn't have to work 9 to 5.
Dave, you said earlier, and I thought it was interesting, you said you found it easier to go and make money versus take a job. Can you kind of elaborate on that?
Well, I think there's so many opportunities out there for people if they're willing to look around and really consider what they're good at, or allow the market to move them. See where there's a need. And for me, being raised by a mom who was very entrepreneurial herself, I learned that it didn't matter what it was, whether mowing lawns or painting houses or selling things door to door, there was always something that somebody needed. And if you were willing to try, you could probably find it.
So when other children were out playing, you did not find it difficult to go door to door selling Fuller brushes with your family?
Well, I didn't really have a choice. I mean, my mom said, you know, she had to watch me. So she said, I need you to come. I need you to carry the wagon and help me.
But did you find it difficult, or did you enjoy it? Did you hate it? Did you love it?
I loved it. I mean, I like people, and we would see lots of different people, and my mom was always very inquisitive with them. And so I learned a lot about people and opportunity.
So, Amy, you're the president of the company. You co-founded it with your husband. Are you just as entrepreneurial as he is?
Definitely not. I would say I'm pretty much the opposite of that. Never thought I would own or run a company, but I'm definitely Dave's biggest fan, and when he said that we can do this, I believed him, and we have.
So you came from a background where you never thought that you would own a company.
Definitely.
And all of a sudden, your husband comes to you one day, and he wants to buy this company, and neither of you have any experience?
Yes, or the money to buy it, really.
How does that work?
That was my question.
Tell us about the Washington Post ad.
Yeah, we were actually at my parents' house one Sunday, and Dave was looking again under businesses for sale in the Washington Post. And all of a sudden, from the other room, we heard, "I found it!" And I thought, uh-oh. And it was something, again, no experience, didn't have the money for it, but he absolutely knew he could make it happen, and I believed that he could.
You believed that he could, even though you weren't qualified to do it?
Yeah, I think, again, I am his biggest fan. I had seen what he had done creating opportunities for himself, going back to graduate school, again, when he didn't have any money, and I just knew that he could do it.
Dave, what was so special about this particular opportunity that you jumped at it?
What was special about it, it wasn't like a typical ad. Usually when you're looking at businesses for sale, you have businesses that service stations or vending machine companies. This was different. It said highly profitable document management company that requires substantial cash, and owners are willing to help out. And for me, that was different than any of the ads I had seen for 10 years trying to look for this.
So how does a husband and wife team, where one is the risk taker, the entrepreneur, and the other one is slow, pull back, how does that work together?
It actually, I think, works really well. Dave always refers to us as, well, I say he's the motor, and he always says I'm the rudder. So it works well because we're sort of a cross-check on each other. We usually do our best work when we're working together because we see the two sides of it. And we trust each other in our different areas of the company. We rarely are making the same decision. So if it's something about growing the company, I defer to him. If it's something about managing the employees or that running the operations, he defers to me. So it actually works well.
So that's how it works well now. What was it like in the early days?
in the early days, we didn't really grow that fast because I have limited skills. I'm the kind of person, I think, that can start something. But I really felt that we needed Amy, who had wonderful organizational skills, had worked as a vice president of a software management company, had 80 people working for her at one point. And I knew that to make it really grow, we needed the glue that held it all together.
Why are you so okay with and so secure with admitting I have limited skills? Why are you not hiding that?
Because we all do. And when we realize that, I think we all will succeed better. It's really how we, at Landon IP, how we grow, because we're not technologists, neither Amy nor me, nor are we patent attorneys. And that's the business we're in. So we feel like if we don't know something, it's much better to find somebody who's smarter than us, who then can contribute to the overall growth of the company.
A few moments ago, you talked about the appeal in the business and buying it. But there was a little more to it than that, was there not? It had something to do with the owners themselves and maybe helping them out?
Right. It was a good case. And I would recommend anybody who wants to start a business not start a business. Instead, look for a business that you can buy. Maybe a couple that's elderly, has a family business, and their life savings is built up in that business. Pay them over time like we did.
Well, tell us how that worked and what it was like doing that.
Well, it was excellent because the former owner essentially had no children, had worked there for a good 15, 20 years and built it to what it was, I thought, a pretty valuable company. And allowed us, because we didn't have much money, to put a small down payment on it. We took a second mortgage on our house and pay the rest over time. And that's available to anybody who's willing to look and talk to the right people who are looking to sell their business because they have their retirement savings locked up in it.
Dave, this environment that you grew up in, a few small young boys with a single mom living on food stamps, did your brothers come away with the same kind of entrepreneurial spirit and drive that you have?
Yeah, in fact, they're both entrepreneurs. My brother owns a large medical device company that he started. It's actually bigger than our company. And I have another brother who's a hazardous materials transportation consultant in Oregon who has travels around the world and has a crew of people that helps companies transport dangerous goods.
Is your mom still alive today?
She is. She has a business. She has a business selling automotive lubricants with my stepdad. She remarried when I was a teenager, and they're down in Richmond, Virginia.
What does she think of your success?
She's embarrassed to talk about it, I think, because when she's not Amy.
Amy says no.
She always says that they're her claim to fame. She always wondered what she would do big in life, and at one point she realized it was her kids that were going to be her claim to fame.
Great.
She's proud of all of them.
Well, how about your parents, Amy? Government workers,
right?
And they've got a daughter who's the president of a company.
Yes.
What do they think?
I don't know that answer, but I do know that my mom says, oh, she was trying to boss people around since she was two. So the fact that I would be bossing 150 people around now doesn't surprise her.
How has your marriage changed given that you run a company together?
Well, I have one good story. We sometimes will sit up in our bed and watch television, and there was one case where we both were using our BlackBerry, and I realized we were sending messages to each other. So that happens sometimes, but I think it's good because if we don't focus on the same things at work, it's perfectly harmonious. But if we try to do the same things, it doesn't work out.
Yeah, the toughest times is when we're in meetings together. Sometimes we're able to say whatever we want to the other one, which isn't always the case in a business environment. So,
has the business been everything you thought it would be? And what I mean by that is having your own business, working together as a husband and wife, et cetera, is it playing out the way you thought it would?
It didn't even enter my consciousness. So it's way beyond anything I ever expected or knew was out there. I think Dave always knew there would be something special. So I'd be interested to hear what you say.
I think it's better than expected. I just wanted to work for myself. I didn't care about growing a big company. I just wanted the thrill of working for myself and having a little more control over the destiny, my destiny and our family's destiny. And for me, that's what I cared about. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful ride.
Has it been a thrill?
It's been a thrill. Every day is a thrill. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And we have great people, so it makes it easy.
Would you please give us the web address for Landon IP?
The web address for Landon IP is www.landon-ip.com, landon-ip.com.
Thanks very much, Dave. We've been speaking with Dave Hunt, CEO, and Amy Hunt, his wife, president of Land and IP. I'd like to thank my co-host, Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation, for helping me with the interview. And please go to our website. Check us out at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back in a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion of Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. This is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Frank McMillan.
And Frank, who are you with?
A company called PeopleShare.
PeopleShare. Well, what is that?
We're a full-service staffing company.
And what does full service mean?
Well, we work with people for clerical, admin, light industrial. We're specialized in the legal side, call center staffing.
Given the economy, are people still using staffing companies right now?
Absolutely. We are growing tremendously right now.
So a typical customer for you would be who?
A lawyer's office, any call center, manufacturing facility that is growing or needs to hire some new individuals.
Yeah. Can you give us a success story?
Well, we have a lot of success stories. One of them is just a lot of the people that come into our office just don't interview well, and they just don't have the opportunity to get in to a location. And we give them that first step into the facility. So it kind of gives them a helping hand to get into a premier company, and then they see their work values and ethics, and then they hire them on as a full-time employee.
Why do you feel this is such important work to do?
Well, I really enjoy this because both sides of the customer, the company that I am recruiting for, and the employees that come in, both benefit tremendously from the efforts that I do. So it's very important.
Are there particular types of clients that you look for?
Light industrial and manufacturing are some very important clients, but call center work is very nice too.
Frank, would you give us your website, please?
It is PeopleShareWorks.com. That's www.peopleshareworks.com.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, David Cooper, of the Bank of America. And I'd like to introduce to you our final guest today, Travis Reese. Travis is the president and COO of a company called Mandiant. Welcome, Travis. And what is Mandiant?
Mandiant is one of the leaders in advanced threat detection response. And what that is actually chasing the hackers through the biggest banks of the world, Fortune 100 companies. So we do the computer forensics and investigations on large-scale intrusions.
So a company would come to you and say what?
Yeah, absolutely. Whether it's the victim that comes to us, whether it's federal law enforcement, whether it's their attorneys, they basically come to us and give you an example. You know, a bank that comes and says, we just lost $10 million over the weekend. Help us find out where the intrusion came from, who did it, and what the losses were.
So you are like a cyber secret agent tracking down the bad guys?
Absolutely. We're one of the firms that has the pleasure and luxury to respond to all of the breaches.
So is this as exciting as it sort of sounds on the outside?
Well, it's unbelievable to see just literally everywhere you use your credit card that's been breached. Some of the major corporations that have got nation-state sponsored threats stealing their intellectual property. You name the development that's going on in the United States, someone's targeting it. And then the banks of the world having Eastern European organized crime literally stealing tens of millions of dollars on a regular basis.
Wow, so this is obviously very important work. How long has Mandiant been in business?
We were founded in 2004 by my partner, Kevin Mandia.
And how big or small? By whatever
we're
metric?
We're 150 folks right now and about $55 million in revenue.
And you came on board in 2006?
Correct.
Why did you do that?
I previously had a company called Aegis Research Corporation, and so that company was acquired by Mantech International, and after the acquisition, I came to Mandiant.
You and Kevin are friends.
Absolutely. We went to the Air Force OSI Academy. We were both special agents in the Air Force back in the mid-90s.
So did he come after you, or did you come up to him and say, hey, Kevin, I'd like to join the company? How did that work?
Kind of a funny story. We solicited each other every year after the Air Force. So we each had different companies. Every year we'd meet, solicit each other, and after the acquisition from Mantech, he won.
And you saw this as a good opportunity. Why?
Absolutely. We really were the first company that built the business presence to say that prevention wasn't going to work. So you always had to have the solution on what comes next after an intrusion. So literally we're riding a wave on every company that we go to that's been breached has bought intrusion detection, firewalls, prevention devices. So we're one of the first firms that built the company around the incident response practice. Wow.
And so where does a cyber secret agent like you hail from?
Good question. I come from upstate New York. I was born in Binghamton, where I had very, very humble roots. Coming out of poverty, living in a world where I had single parents, a brother and a sister. I can remember the days of using food stamps. Unbelievable kind of beginnings on a humble side. When I was in high school, it's kind of interesting. I knew it was one of two things I wanted to do. I either wanted to be James Bond and go the 007 route, or I wanted to be an astronaut. I was intrigued.
Aren't you sort of James Bond right now?
Not exactly. It's nowhere near as exciting as the movies when you're sitting behind the computer screen chasing criminals. But the reality is it led me to the Air Force to become a special agent, which led me to the specialized training.
But you are chasing bad guys, though.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there may be something to the desire of a young child and your career aspirations.
Absolutely. Trying to define what's going on and investigate is something that's just a passion of mine.
So in these early years, you were formed by some of these roots with your family and your inquisitiveness, and how did that really play out for you?
I can remember being young and trying to figure out how the toaster works, so taking it apart, the early days of the x86 computers, diving into the computer to figure out how is this thing working. So I had a very analytical mind and very inquisitive. So I always wanted to investigate everything around me, which I think is what led me to becoming a special agent in the Air Force.
And that's part of what led you. You also mentioned high morals, and tell us where they came from and what they have to do with the line of work you're in.
Absolutely. I think I've worked before I can even remember my childhood. I mean, the first memories I have was being in a paper route and literally driving my bicycle with more papers on my back than I could humanly carry with the bike. So I had a very humble beginning where I knew I had to work extremely hard to get where I'm at. And it's even nowadays, I take my kids back to the apartment that I grew up in to show them the poverty I grew up, to kind of give them the lesson of, you know, this is where you can start. You can get anywhere you want if you work extremely hard.
You mentioned your siblings took other directions in their careers and paths. What are they doing, and how do you think they were shaped differently from you?
I'm the middle child. I don't know if that means much, but I've got an older brother who stayed in the hometown. He's doing chip work and other things for IBM. And then I've got a younger sister who kind of hailed from more of the hippie days, and she still wears the dreadlocks and is a teacher in Kuwait. She does international studies. Her and her husband both teach and go from country to country teaching in American schools.
So why are you different?
Good question. There's nothing that I can look back in my history and say, why did the DNA change, you know, the siblings? All I can say is I definitely had a stronger desire towards national security and law enforcement. And I think it came from just working my entire life and being very inquisitive and seeing the Air Force commercials. I literally had the words "aim high" on my high school graduation cap. So I knew before I even graduated my path was Air Force. And while I was in the Air Force, I can remember my path. Things just moved too slow. I wanted to run twice as fast. It almost became an absolute crystal clear path that I had to get out of the military after 10 years to do an entrepreneurial sort of startup.
I don't necessarily conjure up images of the Air Force moving slowly. How fast do things need to move for you to feel comfortable in your skin?
I haven't found an environment that moves fast enough yet. But the reality is if, and I've worked with a lot of different government agencies, and I have a ton of respect for the different intelligence communities and Department of Defense and federal law enforcement that I've worked in. But the reality is I'm not a fan of bureaucracy. And I tend to align myself in very agile environments, and that's what I absolutely love about the company.
When did you start your first company?
So I co-founded Aegis Research Corporation's Computer Forensics and Intrusion Analysis Group back in 2000, after 10 years in the Air Force, and built one of the fastest growing classified computer forensics organizations in the defense contractor space at the time. Literally spent 6 to 7 years building more of the classified computer forensics capabilities, chasing the terrorists around, trying to identify where they're at, what they're doing, building prototype tools and technologies, and had an absolute great time in Aegis Research.
Are we good at this in this country? Are we good at chasing terrorists and preventing these sorts of crimes, or are we falling behind?
We're absolutely the most dominant country that has a cyber capability. But the reality is we've spent so much focus in what I call CT counterterrorism that we've lost some of the focus on some of our other adversaries and what they're doing to us from a cyber intrusion perspective.
Yeah. How did you learn how to run a business?
Good question. So I went straight from high school into the Air Force, got my college degree in the Air Force, and started the first company with no business background. So didn't have the formal education, didn't have the MBA, so I did it literally on the job. And then later in life decided, you know, go back, get some executive education from Harvard. So I've supplemented some of the on-the-job training.
So you're a risk taker then?
Love risk.
Actually, if I could counterpoint that a bit, my sense is you don't feel any risk because you told us in the green room you're way too overconfident. So what's the reality here?
Yeah, the reality is I tend to have the glass is half full attitude. I really look at the positive versus the negative. Kind of goes well with my partner, Kevin Mandia, who really looks at kind of the risk side of the equation.
How does somebody who grew up in poverty on welfare have a glass half full mentality?
That's a good question. It's probably more afraid of failure than looking for success. So if you never want to fail, if you never want to be in the position you were in when you were in poverty, that tends to drive you extremely hard.
Yeah. You said that everything came easy to you. Have you ever failed at anything?
I'm sure I have.
But you just can't remember it.
I'm not, you know, I don't have that big of an ego. There's no question that I'm sure there's things that I could have done better. I'm always analyzing kind of where I'm at, what I'm doing.
What's the hardest thing you've had to face in your business life?
I would say the hardest professional challenge that I've had is when I made the decision to leave Aegis Research Corporation after the acquisition to Mantech and leave all my friends, family, and folks that I built the company to start my second entrepreneurial sort of experience. That was the hardest.
Why did you?
Bigger opportunity. The reality is after the acquisition, it started going into an environment of larger company, and I just saw a huge opportunity on the outside to run faster and build another company.
Yeah. We're going to ask you, the experts, something that many people are probably dying to know, and that is, how bad is it out there?
It is a lot worse from a cyber threat perspective than most of the folks realize, worse than the media portrays. The headlines that folks read about all of the breaches that are occurring, you name it, whether it's Sony, Epsilon, all of the ones that have occurred this year, there are literally thousands of them that never make the headlines.
The average person is at risk in what way?
The reality is if a targeted cyber attacker wants to gain access to you, there is nothing you're going to be able to do from a preventative standpoint to stop it. But that's just the targeted threats. Not every person sitting in their home is being targeted on a daily basis. My company is primarily dealing with large enterprises, companies, banks. But the reality is everyone, myself included, is vulnerable to an attack.
Yeah. Travis, give us the web address for Mandiant, please.
Sure. It's www.mandiant.com.
Spell that for us.
Mandiant.
So www.mandiant.com. Great. We've been speaking with Travis Rees. Travis is the president and COO of Mandiant. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including John Rendon, co-founder and president of the Rendon Group, Gretchen McCracken, co-founder and CEO of Golden Key Group, Dave Hunt, CEO, and Amy Hunt, president of Land and IP, and of course, most recently, Travis Rees, president and COO of Mandiant. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Brian Biondi of League Asset Corporation, Phil Horegi of Saber Systems, and David Cooper of the Bank of America for helping me structure the interviews, hopefully giving you an interesting educational experience. More than anyone else, I'd like to thank you, the listening audience. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't even have a radio show. Don't forget to check us out on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. We've been broadcasting from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This has been your host, Mike Mannion of Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on Federal News Radio. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on Federal News Radio. That's executiveleadersradio.com.